From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jack Nicholson and Kathy Bates are nominated for Academy Awards for their roles in the film About Schmidt. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Alexander Payne. He also made the satirical comedies Citizen Ruth and Election. Also, we meet and listen to the music of Alvin Youngblood Hart. His CD, Down in the Alley, is nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Traditional Blues Recording. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word appeasement, a word that's been used in reference to giving Saddam Hussein more time, a word that developed dishonorable connotations in pre-World War II Europe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A professor at the University of South Florida was one of four people arrested today for allegedly helping fund and support a terrorist organization. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The arrest came after a federal grand jury indicted eight people who prosecutors said are members or leaders of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, designated by the U.S. as a terrorist group. Four of those indicted live overseas. One of those arrested was Sami Al-Aryan, a computer engineering professor at the University of South Florida, who has long been the subject of federal investigations. Al-Aryan has consistently denied any links to terrorism, but Attorney General John Ashcroft identified him as the group's U.S. leader.
In his capacity as a leader in the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, he directed the audit of all monies and property of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad throughout the world.
Al-Aryan's attorney called his client a political prisoner and said he's now on a hunger strike. Greg Allen, NPR News.
The Bush administration and the British government are working or reported to be working out the final details of a new UN resolution calling for the use of force to disarm Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the administration is serious about the resolution, despite expected opposition from most of the UN Security Council.
We still believe that a resolution is appropriate. We're working on such a resolution, and we don't put a resolution down unless we intend to fight for that resolution, and unless we believe we can make the case that a resolution is appropriate.
Officials say the resolution could be presented as early as Monday. President Bush was in Georgia today to promote his tax cut package and get the endorsement of Democratic Senator Zell Miller. Susanna Capilouto reports from Georgia Public Radio.
Zell Miller introduced the president, calling him a leader with a good heart and a spine of steel. Miller is the first Senate Democrat to support the president's multi-billion-dollar tax cut plan. It includes provisions to accelerate personal tax cuts approved in 2001 and eliminates dividend taxes. Speaking at a suburban Atlanta high school, Mr. Bush said he and Senator Miller believe that the plan will boost jobs by encouraging consumption and investment.
I agree with Zell with this economic theory that when a person has more money in their pocket, they're likely to demand somebody to produce them a good or a service.
Other Democrats say the president's plan is skewed to help the rich and will fuel an already out-of-control deficit. Several Republicans have also voiced concern over its cost. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capilouto in Atlanta.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 85 points, or 1%, to close at 7,914 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 3 points to close at 1,331. The S&P 500 lost 8. This is NPR News. A federal jury in Virginia has convicted Brian Regan of trying to sell classified military information to Iraq and China. The panel found the former Air Force Master Sergeant not guilty of a third count of attempting to sell secrets to Libya. The jury must now decide whether Regan offered to sell military secrets that were important enough to warrant a death sentence. A report shows that Southerners and African Americans are more likely to die from strokes than other Americans. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Scientists knew that fatalities from stroke differ widely from place to place and among ethnic groups. Now a report from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention pinpoints the differences. African Americans are 1.4 times more likely to die of stroke than whites, and to die at an earlier age. Among blacks, almost half of stroke deaths occurred before age 75, but for whites it was only 25% by that age. The report also confirmed the existence of what doctors have long called the stroke belt, made up of the southeastern states and the Mississippi Delta. Federal officials said prevention efforts need to be stepped up in high-risk areas, such as helping people change diets and providing faster access to emergency care. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Federal health officials say that so far there have been no serious reactions among more than 4,000 civilians who've received smallpox vaccinations. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the vaccinations are now being carried out in 27 states. Statistics from vaccinations years ago suggest there could be as many as 50 life-threatening reactions out of every million people who are vaccinated for the first time. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Life of David Gale, starring Kevin Spacey, Kate Winslet, and Laura Linney, directed by Alan Parker, in theaters Friday.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jack Nicholson and Kathy Bates are nominated for Academy Awards for their performances in About Schmidt. My guest is the director of the film, Alexander Payne. He also directed Election and Citizen Ruth. About Schmidt is set in Omaha, where Payne grew up. Nicholson plays an insurance actuary who is forced out of the life he knows when he retires and his wife dies suddenly. The movie is loosely based on the novel of the same name by Lewis Begley. The movie also draws on a screenplay that Payne and his writing partner started about 10 years earlier called The Coward, about a retiree in crisis. The Coward had narrative problems Payne couldn't fix. After he was sent a copy of About Schmidt, he found similarities between it and The Coward. His movie drew from both with a generous amount of rewriting. Here's a scene from About Schmidt shortly after the funeral of Schmidt's wife. He's talking with his daughter, played by Hope Davis.
Dad? Why did you get such a cheap casket?
What?
I could tell you got the cheapest casket. Everybody could.
Oh, that is not true. That is not true. I specifically did not choose, as you say, the cheapest casket. There was one less expensive which they showed me, and I refused it.
You mean a pine box?
Well, I don't remember what it was.
She waited on you hand and foot. Couldn't you have splurged on her just once?
Hey, what are you talking about? What about the Winnebago out there? What do you call that? That's an expensive vehicle. I didn't want to get it, but I did. That was completely your mother's idea.
She told me she had to pay for like half of it. She said she had to sell some of her stock or something to pay for it.
Well, that was her decision. I was willing to go as far as the Mini Winnie, but no, she had to have the Adventurer. She wanted the whole shebang. What was I supposed to do, tell her she couldn't? Was her money. No. You can't call me to task on that one. Mm-mm.
Alexander Payne, welcome to Fresh Air. And About Schmidt, Schmidt faces two turning points right at the start of the film, his retirement and the death of his wife. And there's just like his life has become this big empty hole. There's no work, there's no marriage, and there's very little meaning that he can find. But he's the kind of person who doesn't have the introspective tools or the language to either express or comprehend what he's feeling. What kind of challenges does that give to you as the screenwriter to write about a character who's facing this kind of crisis of meaning but has no kind of tools to comprehend or speak it?
Yeah, but that's the point of the film, is the guy who's suddenly aware, waking up to what's missing in his life, but he lacks the tools to correct his life. And some people have said, oh, you know, the character doesn't change, he doesn't grow, he's just miserable through the whole film. And I say, well, yeah, you know, he's made his bed and he has to lie in it. But that's precisely why we used the device of his letters to the little boy in Africa to get some access to his interior life.
Yeah, this is a boy in Africa he adopts through like a TV commercial. And the boy, he confides all of his thoughts in the letters to this boy. And of course, the boy is too young and too culturally distant to comprehend any of it. So had you been watching one of these commercials when you came up with the idea?
Yeah, and I think I came up with the idea a long time ago, and just because I was watching one of those ads, and, oh, soon you'll be corresponding with your foster son or daughter. And I thought, well, I don't know, what would I say? And then you just take that thought to its most absurd extension, and you just, you know, pour out your whole life and the specifics of your life. And then later, I think when I was initially alone writing The Coward about this old guy in Omaha, older fellow in Omaha who retires, I thought, well, what if he sponsors a boy in Africa and uses him as his unseen, distant, and absurd confessor?
Well, Jack Nicholson is nominated for an Oscar for his performance in About Schmidt. What do you have to do to get Nicholson to be in your movie?
Well, in this case, it was, in a way, alarmingly easy because About Schmidt, the book, had been submitted to me by two producers, one of whom is a guy named Harry Gittes, like Gittes of Chinatown, who is Jack Nicholson's very good old friend. And so seeking to create a film for his friend, Mr. Nicholson, Harry Gittes had found the book About Schmidt and had shown it to Jack Nicholson, and Jack Nicholson had read it and said, yeah, potentially this is interesting, and if you get a decent script conjured up, show it to me and I'll consider it. So that's when Gittes and Michael Bessman found me, and then I expressed interest and then lured Jim Taylor into working with me on it. And so we knew while writing the script that Jack Nicholson would be the first actor to read it when we finished, with no assurances whether he would take it or not, of course. So we finished the second draft, and Nicholson read it the next week, and then I met him, and he said he wanted to do it. So it was fairly easy. I mean, it was hard getting, I mean, working on the screenplay was very hard, of course, as it always is, but it worked out very nicely that way.
After Nicholson accepted the part,
yeah,
were the questions he asked you about the character of Schmidt, you know, things he wanted you to explain to him, or, you know, interpretations of the character he asked about?
No, he didn't really. We spent many hours. Our rehearsal process, if you can call it that, was simply my going to his house and spending many hours in conversation with him. Mostly not about the work we were about to do, but about other things, so that he's a completely enjoyable guy. And then also we were both interested in getting to know each other before beginning the film. And I had basically just two directions to give him, one of which was that I needed him to be a small man, a very mediocre, unself-aware fellow, and that also he act as someone who is older than he is, Nicholson is, because even though he's more or less the same age as Warren Schmidt, he in real life is much more youthful and vital than Warren Schmidt is. So I needed him really to be, because the older Warren Schmidt is in the movie, then the more the movie's about what it's about in terms of aging and death.
Anything you found particularly interesting about Nicholson's approach to getting into the role and preparing for the role?
Yeah, how profoundly, I don't know if you want to call it method or what, but just how profoundly he was living the part of Warren Schmidt. And the months preceding shooting, he would tell me he would just pat around his house and become and be thinking about Warren Schmidt, and even while shooting, remaining in character, keeping that alive, keeping Warren Schmidt alive inside of himself all the time. And he confessed to being very depressed because he saw he was getting into Warren Schmidt through Schmidt's depression. And he was very happy when shooting ended because he could kind of throw off that onus of a depressive man.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Schmidt's depression is that he doesn't even know he's depressed. It's the kind of depression in someone who doesn't understand depression, isn't aware of depression.
Wouldn't admit to it, would never, very Midwestern, would never consider going to a psychiatrist or a therapist. And even in his letters to Ndugu, when he's confessing how he really feels, he often just as much lies to Ndugu as well and puts a happy face on what he's doing.
Is that an approach to living in the world, to seeing the world that you understand because you've seen that?
Yeah, you see it a lot. You hear it a lot among Americans. I mean, it's hard for me to generalize, but I certainly have experienced that a lot. No, 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 I'm fine. You know, I'm a little down these days, but I'm getting by. And that's pretty much a survival mechanism.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Payne. He co-wrote the screenplay and directed the movie about Schmidt. Kathy Bates is nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. Can you describe her character in About Schmidt?
A very overbearing, garrulous, sometimes awful woman who would basically tell her life story to people at the bus stop.
Right.
That's what I would say. What would you say?
I'd also say, and we'll get to this in a moment, that she's incredibly inappropriate with her behavior and her sexuality.
Yeah, everything that Schmidt is not.
Yeah. Well, let me play a short clip with Kathy Bates. And the Nicholson character, his daughter, is marrying Kathy Bates' son. So Nicholson is at Bates' house for a little pre-wedding dinner. And he realizes this family is living on a different planet than the planet he lives on, because they're like ex-hippies. They're, in his mind, incredibly inappropriate in their behavior. Anyways, she's talking with him about raising her son, who she loves, but Schmidt really hates him, and Schmidt thinks that this son is incredibly unworthy of his daughter.
Now, Randall, he knows how to treat a woman. Honestly, don't you think he's something special?
Well, I know Jeannie seems to be very taken with him.
Well, that always helps, doesn't it? When I had my hysterectomy, that boy did not leave my side for 1 minute. Not 1 minute. People used to raise their eyebrows because I breastfed him until he was almost five, and I say, well, you just look at the results. I raised a sensitive, devoted boy who has turned into a sensitive, devoted man. And he's also quite easy on the eye, if I do say so myself. Don't you agree?
That's Kathy Bates and Jack Nicholson in a scene from About Schmidt. My guest is the director, Alexander Payne. Now, the scene that's most talked about that Kathy Bates is in is the scene in which, you know, a little later in the movie, she's invited Schmidt to take a dip in her hot tub. And then, much to his shock and dismay, she strips and climbs in with him. I've heard a lot of people talking about that scene. And I know a lot of people have interpreted it as, isn't it wonderful to see a mature woman who has a full body being so comfortable with her sexuality? And my take on the scene is, God, she's behaving so inappropriately in that scene.
Yeah.
It's not about being comfortable with her sexuality.
For me, it's just what that woman would do. I mean, I don't think she has the hot tub in her own backyard, and why would she wear anything when she goes into it? She doesn't think anything of it.
Right. When did you break the news to Kathy Bates that she'd be naked in a scene?
Well, it's in the screenplay, so she read the script even before I ever met her, so she knew it was there. And she wanted to play the part. She had some concerns about that scene so that it wouldn't be exploitative in any way, she wanted to be comfortable in the moment of doing it and then comfortable also sitting in the cinema with other people watching that scene. So we talked about exactly what would be shown and how we would shoot it, and then we did it.
I guess if I were her, I'd want to make sure that if people laughed, they were laughing at the moment and at the conflict of the two personalities, as opposed to laughing because she's not skinny like everybody else who we see nude in the movies.
Yeah, but I don't think about how we see everybody else in the movies. It's such a weird thing. We're so not used. I mean, I get so many questions about this film that are more about the context in mm-hmm. which this film, about other films. But, mm-hmm. How did you get Nicholson to do this? And, you've got a slightly older woman getting naked here and she's not thin as a rail. And I don't know. I never really know how to answer those questions. And if I'm lured into a political discussion somehow about image of women, I don't really know what to say. All I know is it's appropriate for that character, and it's
right,
funny.
Right.
And it's funny. And maybe it's a problem not with my film but with other films, that something like this would just cause such a, not a major fuss, but I certainly get a lot of questions about it.
My guest is Alexander Payne. He directed the film about Schmidt and co-wrote the screenplay. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Payne. He directed the film about Schmidt and co-wrote the screenplay. He also directed the films Election and Citizen Ruth. How did you fall in love with movies?
Oh, I fell in love with movies very early in my life. My parents, my mother in particular, were big moviegoers, and they would take me. And also, I became very interested early on in life in old movies. I liked silent comedy very much. And then movies from the 30s, particularly Warner Brothers, gangster pictures, and Universal horror films. And I just became kind of obsessed with older movies, particularly older comedies. And my father had a restaurant. He was partners with his father. My grandfather in a restaurant in downtown Omaha, and we had a not even a Super 8, but a regular 8 projector at home, which had been a bonus from Kraft cheese. And in those days, you'd get 3 or 12 minute shortened versions of films at the camera store. So we had some of that. My brothers had bought some of those, and I was
had 3 minute versions of films.
Yeah.
Like what
yeah.
films did you see the 3 minute version of?
Oh, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman and Abbott and Costello movies and Mummy movies. And there used to be a company called Castle Films. And then later there was Black Hawk Films in Davenport, Iowa. That was much more serious because you could buy whole silent features from them as well as two reel shorts in regular 8 and Super 8 formats as well as 16. But I was a kid. I started buying these films early on and into my teens and sending away for because, you know, this is before video. This is in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and so there was no video, obviously. And to see old movies, you had to scour the TV guide every week, or if you were lucky enough to have any kind of revival house in town, or you had to send away for them and actually get prints. And the cheapest way to do it was regular 8.
Do you think watching so many silent films and early comedies affected your sense of what you want from a movie as a director, or what kind of performance you want from actors, what kind of look you want?
Well, I think so, because even though my films are very written and the verbal aspect is very marked, I think, really what I'm more interested in is characters in space and finding dialogueless solutions to getting across exposition, you know, searching for cinema somehow. And I'm a big sucker for gags, and the Golden Globes a couple weeks ago, they were calling about Schmidt a drama, which is fine. That's how the Hollywood Foreign Press and New Line decided to submit it. But I always start out making comedies, but comedies rooted in maybe serious subjects.
Didn't Nicholson actually almost correct them when he accepted the award? Did anyone notice this is a comedy?
Yeah, well, he said he was, I don't remember exactly what he said, but befuddled and a little bit ashamed because he said, I thought we were making a comedy.
That's right, yeah. I guess you thought so too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm surrounded by very funny collaborators because I work with the same team over and over again, my co-writer and composer and cinematographer and production designer and editor and casting people, and we're always looking for what's funny. I mean, hopefully, and sometimes we turn away from what's funny and let something serious be serious. You have to have that. But I think I kind of lament that comedies are underappreciated these days in terms of being able to treat serious subjects.
When you fell in love with movies, how did you know that what you wanted to do was direct?
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know for the longest time. As a kid, I wanted to be a projectionist at first, and then, you know, as a little kid. And then, in college, I mean, the idea of going to film school was such a distant and far off and seemingly unrealistic dream. But when I was a senior in college and thinking about what professional school I would attend, really all I could think of was journalism and film. And so I applied to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and 5 film schools. And then said, well, let me see what I get into, and then I'll decide. Because I had done no film work in college at all. And then when I got my acceptance letters to film schools, I thought, oh, I have to go. I have to try this.
Did you ever get to sit in the projectionist booth with a professional?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've done that a lot. It's fun.
I mean, when you were young, did you do that?
No, I didn't. I never did. I have since then, but I didn't as a kid.
What's fun about it once you're a filmmaker and an adult?
I don't know. It's just I like the chatter of the projector. I mean, it's corny stuff. You're asking me to say corny things, but I like the smell of film and the chatter of the projector and I don't know, just all that corny stuff.
So what is your next project? Can you talk about it at all?
Yeah, sure. It's the adaptation of a so far unpublished novel called Sideways. And it's about two fairly loser guys from San Diego who go wine tasting for a week, the week before one of them is to be married. And it's about their rather pathetic misadventures during that week.
Well, congratulations on the success of About Schmidt, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Alexander Payne directed the film About Schmidt and co-wrote the screenplay. Jack Nicholson and Kathy Bates are nominated for Oscars for their performances in the film. Here's Nicholson reading a letter to the Tanzanian orphan he sponsors through the mail. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When I was a kid, I used to think that maybe I was special, that somehow destiny had tapped me to be a great man. Not like Henry Ford or Walt Disney or somebody like that, but somebody, you know, semi-important. I got a degree in business and statistics and was planning to start my own business someday, build it up into a big corporation, watch it go public, you know, maybe make the Fortune 500. I was gonna be one of those guys you read about. But somehow, it just didn't work out that way. You've got to remember, I had a top-notch job at Woodman and a family to support. I couldn't exactly put their security at risk. Helen, that's my wife. She wouldn't have allowed it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the World of the Disabled by Andrew Potok, author of Ordinary Daylight. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet singer and musician Alvin Youngblood Hart. His CD, Down in the Alley, has been nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Traditional Blues Recording. And our language commentator, Jeff Nunberg, considers the word appeasement, which has been used in the debate about Iraq, and developed dishonorable connotations in pre-World War II Europe. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is blues singer and guitarist Alvin Youngblood Hart. His latest CD, Down in the Alley, is nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Traditional Blues Recording. Robert Gordon, author of a recent biography of Muddy Waters, writes, "At the list of the great living blues players, find Alvin Hart up there at the top." Songwriter, guitarist, and singer Dave Alvin writes, "Hart embodies the powerful paradox of the blues. He understands that the blues has always been rooted in tradition, yet boldly progressive." Let's start with a track from Hart's CD, Down in the Alley.
Chain my clothes.
Alvin Youngblood Hart, welcome to Fresh Air. And now I've got to ask you about the record that we just heard. You know that holler that you do on that song? Is it hard to learn? I mean, did you just like start doing that, or did you have to practice the holler before you felt like you really got it?
My mom's family down in central Mississippi, they raise cattle, you know, cattle and horses and stuff. And there's a couple of relatives of mine that are still doing that. So when I was a teenager and in my early 20s and stuff, hanging out down there, and I was living there for a little while back in the 80s, you have to feed the cattle in the wintertime, you know, with stored hay. So you have to get out there and call them to where the hay is. And that particular little holler, that's how we used to call the cows. So I don't want to do it here in the studio, as there might be a stampede.
That's very wise. Yeah. So it was really like a cowboy holler.
Yeah.
Now, I'm always interested in how people discover music that isn't of their time. So how did you find the blues?
Oh, well, it found me, you know. I guess in a way, you know, I was kind of born into it, and I've heard various family members singing and playing it since day one. So being that, you know, my whole family comes from central Mississippi, you know, that's where John Lee Hooker said all the best blues singers were at, because it was the worst place, as he put it. I don't really think it was the worst place, but I know what he was talking about, you know.
Now, I know you're self-taught. You've brought your guitar with you, so can I ask you to show us some of the first things that you figured out how to play, rhythms or styles, you know, that you heard on record that you really wanted to learn yourself?
I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I think the first thing would have been like trying to play along with my mom's Jimmy Reed records, you know. Going up, going down, going up, down, down, up, any way you want to let it roll, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Right. Yeah, and how'd you learn how to play bottleneck guitar?
Watching Roy Clark on Hee Haw.
That's what all the blues musicians say. Hee-haw, yeah.
gotta learn from the best, right?
Yeah. So what could you see on TV of his fingers?
Well, the main thing was, you know, that he pulled like a jelly jar out, and he says, "I'm gonna do a trick with this," you know, and he started playing slide with a jelly jar. So I said, "Hey, I can do that," and got my brother's guitar and started sliding up and down with probably about 9 then, I guess. You know.
What did you use as your first slides?
A jelly jar.
Mm-hmm. What do you...
Then, Then I graduated to like a pill bottle, you know. They made glass pill bottles back then.
What do you use now?
Spark plug wrench.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
That seems to...
Yeah, I can see that. It's like a little metal canister. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to like to use a piece of glass, but when you're traveling around and you have a little bag with that stuff in there, the glass tends to get broken, and you don't want to get ready for a show and reach in there and grab a handful of broken glass, so kind of stuck with the spark plug wrench.
Did you bring one of them with you?
Oh, yeah.
Can you show us how it sounds?
Sure. Let me dig it out here. We'll pretend. No.
The sound of slide guitar is one of the first things that really got me interested in the blues. I'm wondering, was it hard to figure out how to do it? I don't just mean technically, but once you figured out, you know, how to move the slide up and down, like what you wanted to hear and how to play it.
I'm still doing that, but you know, I'm still trying to figure out the hows and whys. But I don't know. You know, I guess there was a combination of things going on. You know, I was trying to play the rhythm and trying to play the slide and trying to sing all at the same time. So, I never really thought about, you know, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the biggie, was just trying to get it all going at the same time.
Well, let me ask you to put it together and play us a favorite blues song.
All right. One of my favorites, I think it's one of my mom's favorites. This was a song I learned from a Booker White record, and it's called Mama Don't Allow.
Thanks for doing that. Did you ever meet Booker White, or did you learn that from a record?
No, I never had a chance to meet Booker, unfortunately. He died in 1977, and at that time I was living in a place called La Puente, California. So.
Now, when you started playing the blues, was it hard to figure out how to play it and find your own voice and your own style as opposed to imitating records that you heard?
Oh, no, I think that was just a thing that came along naturally with time. Hopefully, anyway. I don't know. I don't know if I'm there yet. But, as you get more comfortable with playing and singing, I think it comes a little bit more natural with time, you know.
Did you ever feel like you needed to look or behave a certain way to, you know, to be an authentic blues man?
No, because I don't really go for all that blues schmooze, blah blah blah, genre segregation and all that whole thing. You know, I'm just in it all for the music.
What are the hazards of that genre segregation?
I don't know. Well, you know, I guess the main one is, you know, you look like some kind of buffoon, but you know, you have all these people dressing up like the 50s or like the 20s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. I don't know that I'd really want to go and live in the 20s, you know. Would you?
Yeah, I'll stick with the flush toilets and everything.
Yeah. I have lived in the I've lived in the other century, and it wasn't all that much of a blast, you know. I mean, when I first started going to visit my grandma and stuff back in the 60s, you know, she was living, you know, like the same she'd lived since 1898, you know, when she was born. So
you're talking about in Mississippi.
Yeah, maybe she had electric lights back then, but that was about it.
Well, did you like that when you were visiting her and you were in another century?
Oh, yeah, it was great. You know, when you're a kid, you know, all that stuff's all right. It's fun. It's like camping full time, you know.
Nice place to visit.
Yeah, you know, go to the well, get the water, all that stuff. But, you know, I don't know, day to day, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I could handle it.
My guest is Alvin Youngblood Hart. His latest CD is called Down in the Alley. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is blues singer and guitarist Alvin Youngblood Hart. His latest CD is called Down in the Alley. So we've established that when you were young, you listened to a lot of blues. Did you listen to contemporary music also? And, you know, what were your friends listening to when you were growing up?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, like, that's the other problem I have with the whole genre segregation thing is, you know, assumptions. People assume I never heard a record that was made after 1935 or something, you know. But obviously I grew up in the 60s. First 12 years of my life I spent in the San Francisco Bay Area while all that was happening, you know. So Sly and the Family Stone were like more or less our local heroes. I went to grade school with the bass player's kid, you know, so there was a lot of that. Everybody who was coming out of the Bay Area at that time, you know, Sly and Jefferson Airplane, you know, I've over the last few years got to know Jorma Kaukonen and Jack Cassidy from the Jefferson Airplane pretty well through Jorma's guitar camp. Actually, one of the highlights, I guess, the highlights of my rock and roll career was going to Wendy's with Jorma and Jack, you know, so, to get Jack a hamburger. So, you know, you know, there were a lot of other things I was listening to in the late 70s when all the fusion things were going on. You know, Stanley Clarke and John McLaughlin, things like that. All the things that you know, kids in high school in the 70s listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Hendrix and Stones, the Stooges, MC5, stuff like that.
I think you can hear a lot of influences outside of the early blues on your previous CD, a CD which is called Start with the Soul. And you're not unaccompanied. You're playing with a band, and I thought I'd play a track from that and ask you to talk about this song. It's called "Once Again." It's an original. Say something about the song and the influences on this.
Boy, I haven't heard it in so long. I forgot the influences, but you know, that song I wrote way back in 1990, I think, or somewhere there. Just, you know, I'd been hanging around hanging around in North Beach, you know, the City Lights bookstore, all that kind of stuff, and actually knew a guy who had a bar in North Beach there for a while. And, you know, I suppose there was even a little bit of like a beatnik flavor in that tune. I don't know. Somebody might hear it. You know, but.
Okay, well, this is Alvin Youngblood Heart from a CD called Start With the Soul. And this is his original song, Once Again.
Once again, my baby boy done skinned his knee. And once again, somebody want a piece of me. And once again, baby, I can't see. For love, yeah, for love.
Alvin Youngblood Heart from an earlier CD called Start With the Soul. Sometimes it seems like there's more white people that listen to blues than African Americans. What have your experiences been in that regard?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they think the music should stand still, you know, or something. I don't know. I mean, I've had a lot of Bob Dylan 1966 moments out there, you know, where, what, you're not playing the blues, you're not playing the old resonator guitar, you know, all that kind of thing.
Right.
So, I don't know, romantic notions or something, you know, I don't know.
So what happens next? Do you know what's going to happen next with you musically, either in terms of recording or just stylistically?
Well, right now we're kind of in limbo. I think we're thinking about trying to record our new band, you know, of our new band of old 70s rock, I guess, you know. The stuff we grew up on, you know. So I've been writing a lot of that lately.
Which is what?
Oh, the band?
The stuff you grew up on.
Oh, you know, all the stuff from the early 70s that when the Stones were great, and, you know, ZZ Top and stuff like that. There was something really magic about, I guess, the year 1972. There was a lot of good rock music came out back then.
Well, Alvin Youngblood Heart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alvin Youngblood Heart will perform this weekend at B.B. King's Blues Club in New York. Heart's latest CD, Down in the Alley, is on Memphis International Records. It's nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Traditional Blues Recording. Here's another track from it.
Mother, children have a hard time some of these days. Mother, children have a hard time some of these days. Then you're crying from door to door. Nobody treats you like a mother can. Mother dead home. Treat you like a mother can. Mother dead home. Father do the best he can now some of these days. Father do the best he can now some of these days. Father do the best he can. So many things he can't understand. Nobody treat you like a mother can. Mother dead home.
Coming up, the word appeasement. It's been used in criticism of those who would give Saddam Hussein more time. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us how the word developed dishonorable connotations in pre-World War II Europe. This is Fresh Air. appeasement. It's a term we've been hearing more of as the debates on the administration's Iraq policy continues. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracing the history of this term and has these thoughts.
The English philosopher Peter Strawson used to talk about expressions that had grown capital letters, as he put it. Those are phrases like the Cold War, the Flood, or the Big Apple, descriptions that have turned into proper names that refer to a specific thing or event. But sometimes an expression gets attached to a particular event without actually becoming a name for it, more like picking up a piece of dirt that it can't scrape off its shoes. Stonewalling, for example. It isn't a proper name, but it always evokes the Nixon administration's response to Watergate. Ditto isolationism or partition. They're each linked to a particular historical moment. Or take appeasement. Whenever it's pronounced, the word conjures up the memory of the British policy of appeasement in pre-war Europe. You think of Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain standing on the steps of 10 Downing Street on his return from the Munich Conference in September of 1938 after he'd handed over the Czech Sudetenland to Hitler. "It is peace for our time," he told the press. "Go home and get a nice quiet sleep." That moment had a number of far-reaching consequences, I mean over and above bringing the world a step closer to a catastrophic war. It sealed the political downfall of Chamberlain, and it revived the faded fortunes of Winston Churchill, who had opposed the Munich decision as a complete surrender to the Nazi threat of force. And it permanently changed the meaning of the word appeasement itself. Before Munich, appeasement didn't have the dishonorable connotations that it does for us. Appease still carried the echoes of the root sense of peace, and its meaning was simply conciliate, bring peace to, or pacify. I mean, before pacify got its feet muddy, too. You recall the verse from the book of Proverbs, "He that is slow to anger appeaseth strife." In fact, Churchill himself recommended a policy of prudence and appeasement toward the Turks when they went to war with the Greeks in 1919. And Roosevelt described Mussolini's conquest of Ethiopia in 1936 as an integral measure for world appeasement. That's the sense that Chamberlain had in mind when he talked about a policy of appeasement. The idea was not so much to capitulate to dictators as to ensure the peace while Britain had time to rearm after the defense cuts that Churchill presided over when he was the defense minister in the 1920s. But no politician since then has been able to talk about appeasement in an approving way. After Munich, the word could only suggest a cowardly capitulation to the demands of tyrants in the hope that they'll refrain from further aggression. That's why the word is so inflammatory when it's used to describe opponents of the administration's Iraq policy. I've been hearing more and more of this. I counted over 80 uses of appeasement in the press last month in stories about Iraq, three times as many as in the month before. And the other day, Condoleezza Rice gave official sanction to the label on Meet the Press when she likened the Securities Council's actions to the appeasement of Hitler in the 1930s. That comparison obviously isn't designed to bring any allies around. It's strictly for the benefit of the administration's own troops. It's part of a blitzkrieg aimed at seizing the moral high ground, even if you have to roll over history and etymology in the process. Whatever your view of the French and German position on Saddam Hussein, after all, it isn't remotely comparable to the attitude that Chamberlain is supposed to have taken towards Hitler. Let's give him what he wants and maybe he'll leave us alone. In fact, neither Churchill nor any other critic of Chamberlain's appeasement policy ever argued for preemptive strikes on Germany. They simply supported what people would now describe as deterrence and containment, the way the French and British are doing now. With the wisdom of hindsight, of course, you could argue that even that would have been an inadequate response to the threat of Hitler. And if you were mind to, you could say that the Security Council is making the same mistake now that Churchill made in 1938. That is, if you're willing to argue that Saddam Hussein represents the same threat to world security that Hitler did back then. But one way or another, that isn't a conversation that anybody's about to launch, at least outside of history department common rooms. The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss once said that every important event lives two lives. One is history and one is myth. Political language plays a big part in that transformation. It turns the lessons of history into a set of cliff notes. All that complicated historical footage is reduced to a couple of stills. Churchill as the resolute foe of bullies glaring over his cigar, Chamberlain as the archetypal Euroweenie with his striped pants, high collar, umbrella, and drooping mustache. And Munich itself has become one of those words like Waterloo or Pearl Harbor, names that have seceded from the flesh and blood past and taken up a life of their own as moral fables in the popular imagination. If some words have grown capital letters and become proper names, words like Munich are proper names that politics has turned into common nouns.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Looking for Spinoza, about the importance of emotions in human life and culture by neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, author of The Feeling of What Happens. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Kevin Spacey, the star of such films as American Beauty, L.A. Confidential, The Usual Suspects, and The Negotiator. Spacey's new film, The Life of David Gale, opens this weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.